Donde está? All right, folks. Welcome to another edition of the Nomite Podcast. My name's Mitch Maxine. Any comments or questions, send them to my Nomite Podcast Facebook page, my personal Facebook page, or an email to nomindpodcast2021@gmail.com. We had some bumps and roadblocks getting this one underway, but we're here now. Let's go around the horn and say hi to everybody. Darren, how are you, brother?
Hola. All is well. All is well. Happy to be here.
Bob, what's going on?
Is that like Spanish? Like all I got is hello, how are you?
I'm hello.
Yeah, fuck Lenny for being late. Like, you know, whatever.
Rick, how are you, man?
Bonsoir, je vais bien.
Aren't we continental? Ooh, we're all over the place now.
You just said I'm going well.
No, I am well. Je va.
No, you said I'm going well.
Je vais bien.
Je suis bien.
That's what my accent.
Je suis bien. Yeah.
I am. No. Yeah.
It's his accent. That's what.
That is another way of saying it, yes.
No, that's the way of saying it.
Okay, fine. That's the way of saying it.
All right, let's...
Je suis bien.
Let's rein this in. Lenny's having a little bit of an issue at the dojo, so hopefully he'll be able to pop on for a bit at the end. Tonight's topic's a little strange. I don't know how many people know this or give a damn, but I listen to a fair number of martial arts podcasts, both because I'm curious about what's out there, and for tonight's reason, which is I've gleaned a couple of talking points from things people have said on other podcasts. I'm not going to mention the name of the podcasts or the names of the people who said this stuff. So you're just going to have to take my word for it that I actually did get these talking points from other podcasts. So
you have this inner core of anger and resentment, and you find it necessary to listen to podcasts that piss you off for some weird psychological reason that I don't understand, because I say to you, just don't listen to it. And you continue to do it. But hey, that's your life and that's your work.
So thanks to Bob, we've got an extra special snapshot into Mitch's psychology. Great. But he's absolutely right. I listen to these other podcasts because they make me insane. So I guess as a cathartic sort of valve for that insanity, I want to talk about some of the stuff I've heard in some of these other podcasts. So let's just start from the top and work our way down. Anybody got anything they want to say before we get going on this? Bob, anything of value?
Nothing of value. It's going to be fun. No.
Anything.
Filtered through what Mitch just admitted about himself, it's going to be very interesting.
Darren, anything you want to say before we get going?
No, I'm hoping you don't get as angry as the last podcast when things didn't go your way.
Yeah, we were scared. We got scared.
Did I get angry? I don't.
Oh yeah,
you did, because we weren't really agreeing with you that everything just went sour after that.
Well, learning point. Hello.
Yeah. The anti-social psychopath says learning point.
Is it my turn?
Yes, Rick, go ahead.
The only thing I gotta say is, Bob, you're right. This has gone to his head. He wants to control what's said, how it's said, and what we say.
If I wanted that, you guys wouldn't be on the podcast.
Oh! Hey.
God damn it. All right, so I've called this one podcast cannibalism, just because I've torn out the heart of other podcasts to display on ours. So here we go, to eat them, exactly. So here we go. Let's start with the first one. The first comment I want to talk about, I'll just read it the way I've got it on the talking points. Now I want to make it clear that these are comments taken directly out of other podcasts. Okay, so here's the first comment. Part of the value of kata is teaching the practitioner to maintain a calm mindset. If you are learning and practicing traditional kata, This will help you maintain a sense of calm when you are sparring.
Bullshit.
Bob, leave it to Bob to cut right to the point there. So talk about that for a minute, Bob.
To be calm when I'm writing an essay or an article for something doesn't make me calm when I'm in a fist fight. This is ridiculous.
Yeah,
when I'm
I think
by myself practicing my techniques by myself and that calms me, how will that help you when somebody's trying to hit you in the head with a hammer?
Yeah, like that's like I listen to meditation tapes to calm me and get my mindset calm. And once again, that doesn't translate into a fight.
Is there no argument to be made, though, that the more you do something that puts you in a particular state of mind, the easier it is to achieve that state of mind? Is that
no? Because you'd have to be put into that state of mind in the other circumstances. You can't have a completely different scenario.
The more you get into fights, the better you're able to calm yourself during a fight.
Yeah, I think if you were trying to do what the high-ranking speaker that stated this, if you were practicing sparring with somebody and you weren't getting hit and you were going slow and then slowly and you did that calmly and then slowly you might have increased it and you do it in such a manner over such a length of time that when you are in a tournament or a fight or whatever, you have that sense of calm because you've done it so often in a calm setting and maybe you can revert back to that. But kata has nothing to do with sparring.
I get your point, Darren, but I'm not even sure of that. I'm not sure that the best way for calm in the midst of sparring match, like a high-level sparring match, I'm not sure the best way to get that is to start slowly and work your way up. It's to throw you right into the middle of fucking high-level sparring, and you'll be freaked out for a year, and then once you get used to that, then it's time to start calming down about it and understanding what it's about.
Yeah, but if you're afraid of water and you can't swim, I don't think the best way is to toss someone in the ocean and then they have a fear of water and they never go back to it. So I think that there has to be a happy medium. I get what you're saying, too. I think there's just a bit of a happy medium in there.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, Rick, you haven't said much on this one. What do you think?
No, I can't interrupt between the two of them.
No kidding.
Yeah. But anyway, I agree with the first part. That kata will... True. kata teaching the practitioner to maintain a calm mindset. Well, to do kata, you have to try to get into that calm mindset. So I guess that part is sort of true where it does teach you to try to get that, but I'm not sure it teaches you to maintain it. But it's, as Darren was saying, when you're sparring, I mean, it's probably, and Bob too, is it's not a great thing to be calm when you're sparring. I mean, you need to get into it. You need to have your reactions. You need to be alert. You don't want to be your mind to be asleep. You got to be ready to react. And meditation isn't a reaction thing.
Unless you're so well-tuned to your kata that you really are in the fighting frame of mind when you're doing it, that might be a mitigating factor where it might actually help. You really have to put yourself in there, and that's not something that's usual, but it's possible, maybe.
If you thought of a kata as only bunku and you were fighting everything, every move you did was against an opponent and you were using your reaction, that might work.
Well, actually, let me throw another different perspective on that. When we did the podcast talking about kata, I explained when I do kata, the last thing that I feel when I do kata is calm. I'm completely at odds because I'm constantly evaluating what I'm doing. Is it right? Is it wrong? How do I fix it? So my relationship with kata is not one that I would describe as promoting or maintaining a sense of calm. I'm not calm when I do kata.
But neither are you in the frame of mind of fighting somebody.
Granted, but I'm closer to a fighting frame of mind than I am to a calm frame of mind. I don't mean to say that I agree with the statement. I don't. I think it's as nonsensical as you guys seem to think it is. That doing kata doesn't help your sparring, and I don't care how much you do kata or in what framework. It's always going to be choreographed. It's always going to be. It's always going to be framed in a way that does not promote a mindset that will help you in kata.
The one thing, I don't know how you guys feel about doing kata in a tournament, but I'm just associating sparring as in, because he's not saying street fighting or anything, it's just sparring. So whether he means just sparring in class, which I don't know whether that helps you or not, because you're going to be calm anyway, because it's not real. So doing kata, it's not real. There's no one attacking you, so you can remain calm if that's what you choose to do. If I'm sparring someone in a dojo, I can also remain calm because I'm not worried about getting hurt. When it actually takes to a tournament setting, that changes everything. I've been doing kata for like a million years in all different variations, the way Mitch describes it, in a meditative thing, as a fitness thing, all kinds of different things. But when I step foot in a tournament to do a kata, even though I've been doing it for a million years, I'm scared shit and I'm not calm at all. And I'm not fighting anybody. I'm just in there and you've got everybody watching you, you're being judged, and the calmness is out the window. So it doesn't matter practicing. I've practiced it for fucking decades and I'm still scared shit when I do it in front of everybody in a tournament. So I don't know. Okay. Maybe I'm practicing it wrong. I don't know.
No, I don't think there's any such thing as practicing it wrong. But put yourself, I think everybody here can put themselves into a ready stance at the beginning of a kata and really fucking imagine that you're in a fight during the techniques that you're doing. And that is I think that's a legitimate frame of mind. Few people do, and we don't do it on a regular basis. Many times we're doing it to remain calm and to think about the techniques, but it's possible to do that, don't you think?
I don't think it is possible to do that. I don't think it's possible to pretend a frame of mind that you're actually not engaged in and have it be organically true to what you would actually be feeling. Like when you do a kata and you say, in my head, I'm going to put myself in the framework of someone who is in a fight and I'm doing these techniques and blah, blah, blah. I think that's a facade. I think it's...
I don't think so.
No, the thing is...
You can kind of... I mean, you can't. It's never going to be the same, but you can try your best to... Yeah, you know, focus and speed and all that stuff as if somebody was attacking you.
Yeah, but that's fine. And I'm not talking about focus and speed. I'm talking about the intellectual angst you feel when you're either in a real fight or in a tournament fight when you're sparring. Yeah. That you can't fake that when you're doing a kata. It's not real. It's not organic. No. It's not.
Of course. I think maybe that you're wrong.
Okay.
Yeah, Bob, Mitch, I mean, every time I get in a fight, I want to step forward into a hook stance and put both my backs and my hands together and strike you in the throat.
That's no. You're being sarcastic, and that's
yes,
great.
Yes, I am.
But that's only because you don't think you can put yourself in the mindset.
Bob, that's like saying you can in an imaginative perspective, understand what it's like for somebody to point a gun at you and really feel that your life is in danger, that you can recreate that anytime you want.
You can get closer and closer to that. Yes, you can.
I don't know, man.
Wait, I'm doing a little acting scenario with somebody with a gun to my head. I can be calm. Or I can actually method act and put myself there. There's a difference, and it's an important difference.
But someone who's never actually had a gun put to his head, and even someone who has, they can't recreate that feeling without that
gun. They might be able to.
I don't know, man. I don't know how to resolve this.
Okay. Yeah, no, I get it. What about if the goal is to get there? If you're trying during kata to do that? How about that?
Okay, so whether you achieve it or not, it's not relevant. It's making the effort that's important. Is that
it's,
what you're saying?
It's relevant. The closer you get, the better. So it is relevant. But
look,
yeah.
I guess, but like I kind of find this conversation where it's drifted to be self-defeating and pointless, because I don't think kata has anything to do with sparring, and I don't believe that kata, no matter how you practice it, will make you a better fighter.
It has something to do with sparring, and that's the point of contention that we struggle with all the time.
But why?
I don't think we struggle with it.
I think we've
managed to separate it, like, long before the podcast, and definitely on the podcast we've hashed it out. Right at the start, you disagreed with the statement. So, I mean, now you're kind of having second thoughts and going, wow, we could do this.
Yeah, it's a conversation. It's a conversation.
Good point. Good point.
That's a conversation.
The only way
yeah,
this
like,
makes
no,
any...
you can't change your mind in the middle of a conversation.
The only way this would make sense is if you practice kata, and the only thing that would help in a fight I could even imagine is that at least you've got like a couple of moves that you might try. It doesn't make you a better fighter, but at least the only thing I can think of is something that would make sense from this is that it gives you a couple of things that you've done in a kata, like a block counter or something, which wouldn't work the way you do it in the kata in a fight, but it gives you the block counter mentality. Maybe, I don't know.
Bob, let me ask you a question. Bob, you're saying that it's possible to approach the same mindset that you have when you fight when you're doing kata, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Isn't it easier to approach that mindset by actually fighting?
Sure.
So why do it in kata?
Why not? Like, we're doing kata anyway. Why not?
Because
why
I
not
think
get there.
Because I think the only value to karate is how you do in a fight. So everything I do in karate should gear toward that.
I didn't say that at all.
Okay, but what I'm asking is, isn't it enough that kata gives you what kata gives you, and sparring gives you what sparring gives you, and
it's not this does this and that does that. You explore this with this, and you explore that with that. Like, I don't understand the problem. If you could put your mindset when you're in doing kata into the mindset of when you're sparring, isn't that
good? That's not what we're doing in the topic. The topic is a calm mindset, and that will help you with sparring.
Wait a second.
We'll help you maintain a calm.
No. Wait. Come on, guys. We've drifted a little bit outside of what the question was.
I don't have a sense of calm when I spar.
I know. I'm trying to bring it back.
Who cares? I'm trying to convince Bob that he's wrong. So I'm not sure, Bob, why it matters that I should be able to achieve a mindset that I would have when I'm fighting, when I'm doing kata. Where's the value there?
Well, first of all, put aside the point that everybody who's an advocate for kata practice is saying that helps you when you're sparring. Okay, put that aside for a moment, and talk about a kata practitioner who wants to try to get there. What's wrong with that? He's doing kata anyway,
nothing. If that's something they've decided in their head that they find some value in, great. Godspeed, go for it. And I will admit that there is a certain value to being able to switch mindsets at the drop of a hat. And maybe that's part of the value that kata adds, is I can do kata and feel conflicted. I can do it and feel calm. I can do it and feel like I'm sparring. I can apply any mindset I care to the fact that I'm performing kata. I think there's a huge amount of value there. To be able to switch mindsets like that, wow. And if doing kata that way achieves that goal, why not? I'm now changing my mind. Here I am changing my mind. I don't agree that kata helps you be a better fighter. If you want to be a better fighter, fight.
Dude, we're on the same page there. Kata.
Right.
Kata doesn't help you per se. Like, we have to talk about efficiency. What's the best way to be a good fighter? And kata is not it. I'm just saying.
And right,
someone who loves doing kata could do it for a myriad of reasons. One of which, if they really got into it, could help them in their attitude while they're sparring. That's all.
And I think now I've changed my mind from what I said earlier, just based on the conversation we've just had. Not that it will help you fight better, but I think the ability to navigate different mindsets at will is a brilliant ability that I certainly don't have, but practicing kata that way might get you there. Darren, Rick, anything to add?
It's the same sort of thing where we say when you meditate at the beginning and end of class, and I've said it myself, if you can control your breathing while you meditate at the beginning and end of class, if you can calm yourself down, or if you control your breathing and you practice in and out very calmly, then if you can apply that while you're sparring, it will assist your, it doesn't make you better at sparring, but it will help you spar. It will help control your breath. In that same sort of vein, then yes, I can see where you're saying it.
Yeah, I to me, what we've drifted off is trying to find an excuse either for practicing kata or just to kind of go along with what the topic was. Like Bob just said, if you're doing this, that's what you do. If you're doing this, that's what you do. Can you get some benefits out of it? Well, of course you can. You get benefits out of doing anything. If you're just doing squats all the time, that has nothing to do with fighting, but it will build up the muscles in your legs. Will it help you fight? Well, in a roundabout way, yeah, because you might have stronger kicks. But that's not the best way to learn how to fight. But if the club you're in does a lot of squats, well, you'll use that and get what you can out of it to achieve your goal. Do you need that to achieve your goal? Probably not. There's other ways to do it, but if that's what the club does, and if kata is part of that club's training, then yes, you will take the benefits out of it. That's a no-brainer. My question is, the other thing I'm just thinking, in all the years of kata and different clubs and different instructors, I've never had anyone teach me to maintain a calm mindset in kata. Almost the opposite. It's like you got to treat it like a fight. This guy's attacking you, and you got to put full force and full speed and focus and all that stuff. No one's ever told me to maintain a calm mindset during kata. So maybe we missed out on something there.
Darren brings up a really interesting point, and I'm going to leverage off it a little bit because it's making me rethink my perspective a little bit. The guy who made this comment, I don't want to mention his name, but I went to the website for his club. And he's listed on his website as a 10th degree black belt in his style. He's been training for a lot longer than I have. He was a very active fighter back in the day. And I'm wondering, am I missing something here?
Because, that's what I was just thinking.
because this guy is obviously making a connection between kata and sparring. And look, listen to any of our podcasts on the topic. I'll just speak for myself. I don't see the connection. I'm sorry. But this guy's got some gravitas to his history and his experience. And I'm starting to wonder if I'm missing something. Am I doing this wrong? Like, I don't know. I still don't see the connective tissue between sparring and kata, but this guy seems to.
But he's not saying it makes you better. It's saying the calm state, how do you say that? The calm mindset would be beneficial in a sparring situation.
No, God damn it.
That's not what he's saying. Wait, that's not what he's saying.
God damn it, that makes me mad.
This will help you maintain a sense of calm when you spar. If you maintain it during kata, helps you maintain it when you're sparring.
That's what he's saying.
What I'm getting out of it.
Yeah, and that's the bullshit.
That's what I just said.
Okay, wait, Bob. Bob, you have to stop.
Obviously, Bob is not maintaining a calm mindset. So
right.
I'm breathing.
Bob, go do a kata.
Yeah.
But not with the eye toward getting better at sparring. Just do kata.
Not with an eye toward being calm during the podcast. Just do the kata. Bob, go ahead and say what you're going to say, but calmly.
This idea that your mindset during one set of activities overlaps into other activities is a pile of crap.
No, actually, hold on.
It just set. Hang on.
Let him finish. Let him finish.
He's already wrong.
I disagree with that too. But
yeah, he's already wrong.
For once, I'm not the one interrupting. Okay. It's a trope. It's a trope in the karate martial arts advertisement marketing world that this will teach you to be a calmer, more what is it? What's that thing? Spiritually knowledgeable, and you know, level-minded person.
I have to interrupt you. Well, Jesus Christ.
Go.
I know what you're getting at, and I'd say the way we were taught and everything, you're absolutely right. But you do have to understand that people with anger issues will go to some sort of counseling and therapy and learn how to remain calm. And during remaining calm and learning the techniques in the therapy helps you when a situation arises that you would normally get angry and lash out. So you can't just throw that person that you're trying to counsel into dangerous situations to see how they react, and hopefully one day they get so used to it they're remaining calm. You have to teach the person the techniques that they can apply when the situation arises. So there is something to that, and that's why I'm sort of looking, maybe we weren't being taught this whole, now I'm just, again, devil's advocate for this, but I never approached kata like that. But there, you can do things to create a calm mindset that will enable you to at least revisit whatever you were feeling there should a situation arise that puts you in a bit anxious or, you know, whatever.
Let me put forth a scenario. You're doing a Taikyoku Shodan, and you have four attackers surrounding you, and you have to perform the kata while they attack. That might be to your point. You might be able to exercise your calmness while you do those things, say slowly, and work your way up to faster and stronger. You may have a really good point, but by yourself,
Yeah, no, I honestly can't see the connection. I'm just trying to see a connection, I literally can't.
Let me jump in for a sec, Bob. You were the one who was advocating a few minutes ago that trying to approach a mindset during kata is a good thing, right? Whatever that mindset is.
What calm mindset?
What?
Whatever. What? No, not just a calm mindset, Bob. You were saying that if you are performing kata or someone's performing kata and they are trying to achieve the same mindset that they have when they spar or fight,
right?
That's not a bad thing, right?
Right.
Are you saying then that if they make the effort, consistent effort over time, to achieve the same mindset when they do kata that they have when they fight, that there's not the slightest possibility that some of that might bleed over to when they're actually fighting?
I thought that was my point.
You just went on, unless I'm mishearing you, like you got very vocal a few minutes ago about how this basic statement is bullshit and you can't.
Oh, my basic statement was that the marketing philosophy of these dojos is that practicing kata improves your calmness and your, you know, whatever. And that bleeds over automatically into the other stuff, and that's the bullshit.
I don't know, man. I can't help but think if I'm doing kata, and I'm not being facetious or sarcastic, I'm starting to wonder if this isn't true. If I work on a particular mindset when I'm doing kata, is it not reasonable that that mindset might bleed over into when I'm doing other things as well, if I have an eye toward making that connection?
Other things. Like, it's like going to a zoo and looking at the animals having, you know, resting in the sun. And look at that elephant over there. He's taking a drink with his trunk. And then going to Africa and being charged by an elephant.
Okay, but if you experience both, like, look, we're not, that's kind of an exaggerated example, because almost nobody will actually go to Africa and be charged by an elephant, seeing one in a zoo. But if you're an individual who goes to zoos and loves animals and elephants and you make semi-annual trips to Africa to see elephants, I think the connective tissue between those two mindsets is a lot easier to make. And I think that's a more reasonable analogy. Because we do kata and we spar. Is it not possible that if I try to maintain a sparring mindset when I do kata, that because I also do kata, it allows me to draw that perspective over into my fighting?
It all depends. All right, fair enough. Fair enough. It's all very complicated, and it all depends on the individual practitioner and what they're trying to do. That's a cop out way of saying yes to everything. If it applies, how's that? Yes,
yes.
If it applies, true. If it applies.
But the mindset. The mindset that even Mitch, you get into a mindset when you start your kata. You've told us the process that you get into when you start your process. Now, when you're doing your kata, you aren't thinking of the next move. You aren't thinking, okay, I have to step forward and do an inside block and whatnot. The time you're doing it, you don't have to think of the actual technique. You've practiced it enough. You know the techniques. So I'm not saying you do an out-of-body thing or anything, but you sort of draw back a bit and you're watching yourself and you're going, oh, I should have done that better. But you're not thinking about the next thing because you've practiced the kata enough that you can do the kata without having to think of the next move. So it becomes a mindset where you're looking, okay, I should have done that better. But you're still doing the next three moves as you're going, oh, I should have done that move better. It doesn't stop your kata. You're in a mindset, and I would call that kind of calm. Same thing can happen when you're sparring. If you have to think when you're sparring someone, oh, he's throwing a punch, I have to block. Probably not the best thing. If you're just reacting, but you're looking for openings and you're looking for, oh, there's a tell. Every time he throws a punch, he just drops his one shoulder. Got to watch that. The next time, boom, 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 boom. Oh, drop the shoulder, bing, bang. And you can do that. That is what I would call a certain mindset where you're not thinking about exactly what you're doing. You're taking sort of an overview and considering things that are going on with your body, but you're not thinking about exactly what you're doing.
I agree.
Please let me talk.
Hey, everybody. Bob Rick, wants to talk again.
I think Bob wants to say something.
Yes,
there's a problem mindset Rick, for you.
Rick, that was a brilliant 5-minute monologue about what's going on when you're doing kata. I'm not kidding. And when you're sparring, Mitch, I'd love to hear your exact feelings about the same thing. What's going through your mind when you're doing kata? I would love to hear that.
What goes through my mind?
I know it's impossible to describe, but Rick did a very good job of trying to. I love that.
What goes through my mind? What, Bob, did you want to say anything else as I get started on this? What goes through my mind when I do kata depends entirely on the environment in which I'm doing the kata. My kata at a tournament is different than my kata when I'm practicing it. My kata when I'm practicing it alone is different than what I do in class if someone is leading the class, because they will define by virtue of them leading the class what I think about when I'm doing kata. So my perspective on what I think about when I do kata is malleable depending on the environment I'm doing it in. So do you want
fair enough, but whoa. Could you get, like Rick did a great job of actually trying to describe it. Could you do the same thing? I personally would love to hear.
I was thinking more along the lines of in a tournament on both of those.
When I do kata, I it's so vastly different. So, Bob, you tell me the environment I'm doing it in, and as clearly as I can, I'll tell you what my mindset is.
Or okay, what I case think of A, it. Case A, you're by yourself. Case B, you're in a tournament.
Okay, when I'm by myself, my kata is the physicality based on my intellectual process is very stuttered and not smooth, because every time I do a move, my mind is completely absorbed with, did I do that move right? I do the move, I pause, I fix my stance, I fix my hand position, I fix my leg position, blah, blah, blah. And then I do the next move. So my mindset, what I think about when I do kata by myself, is wholly concerned with proper technique, proper body motion, proper weight distribution, all of that stuff. So it ends up looking very stuttered and fractured because there's no smoothness to it, because that's what I'm thinking. Now, when I'm getting ready for and going in a tournament, it's different because I understand that the only reason I'm in this tournament is to win. I think anyone who enters a tournament for any reason other than win is an idiot. So when I go into a tournament, the only thing I have in my mind is I want to win the tournament. I want to win this division. And I understand how my kata needs to look in order to win. So my mindset and what I think about is more to do with smooth transitions from stance to stance and technique to technique. It's more to do with timing of individual techniques relative to the other techniques. It's more to do with how it looks than it is how it feels. That's probably the best way to say it.
That was great. Darren, do you have any sort of comment?
Yeah, funny enough, it's almost to a T what Mitch just said. The only difference is I don't enjoy practicing on my own anymore. So I like it when I'm in a class and you have to do it because that's part of the class. And I enjoy it. I don't think, oh, geez, kata. I enjoy doing that. And I enjoy, say, before a class or on a Saturday or whenever it's like open workouts and someone says, here, do this kata with me. I'll lump right in and I'll do it. So I'm all for that. I just don't enjoy doing it by myself. And if it's for a tournament, it's exactly what Mitch said, and I'll do it by myself. But I have a goal, and I know exactly what needs to be done for the tournament. And the only reason I'm doing it over and over is to try to do it the way I think the judges would like to see it. I don't these days get anything out of kata to do it on my own. That's all.
I wonder as individuals get older whether the joy or the value of doing kata inherently becomes less prominent?
No, like, I would almost think of the opposite. I should be developing that calm mind and the meditative state and all that when doing it as you get older, because you're not able to put the same focus and energy and all that into it. So maybe you should be looking to get something different out of it. So those other aspects would be something that you could get. I just don't.
That's one of the greatest ironies of how I was taught to do kata and how the value of kata was explained to me. Mark Bell used to say, when you're too old to fight and you're too old to do self-defense and flips and rolls and all that stuff, you'll still be able to do kata. He said that in a way that I think was supposed to offer some level of comfort, and now it just offers frustration. I don't find myself comforted by the fact that in my old age, I'll still be able to do kata. Like, I'm sorry, that doesn't give me comfort. That makes me frustrated.
It's like a cop. Oh, I'll still be able to do that.
Oh, I can still do kata. Nurse,
I want to do kata.
Please unlock this, because I need to do a kata.
I can't follow that.
I want to do kata.
Please unlock this. Oh, God damn it. All right, we've spent 45 minutes talking about the first talking point. Let's go around the table once. Last comments on the actual talking point, which is teaching calm mindset and being able to transfer that into a sparring circumstance. Bob, last comments on that.
Still bullshit.
Rick.
Well, I think I can see what he's trying to say. I don't go along with it 100%. But if you can get a calm mindset doing stuff, you might be able to transfer it. But I don't see the point of having a calm mindset while you're sparring, though.
Darren.
Yeah, I'm not going to call it bullshit, but I'm going to disagree with it. And I haven't, despite the discussion, I haven't been convinced otherwise. I've picked up a few extra things that I would consider, but I'm still not buying the actual point.
I have to come in on what Rick said a minute ago, and this might start a whole new conversation and what the hell. But I, outside of movies and TV shows that show people fighting, I don't see a lot of people being very calm when they're fighting. At tournaments, for instance, and the occasional real life scenario that I found myself in, I don't see much calm there. Like this whole notion of, oh, you know, Zen mindset and Om, and I will be able to remain calm and block everything that's coming out and all that crap. I tend to look at that as Hollywood bullshit, because I know when I'm fighting, I don't feel calm at all.
A matter of fact, you don't want to feel calm. You want to feel this fucking adrenaline coursing.
And I think that Bob is right, and I think that that's nature's way of heightening your ability to react in those kinds of circumstances. So
yeah, you just have to use the heightened activity or the stress or whatever you feel, you have to use it to your advantage. That's exactly. I think that's what most people
teach. You got to control it, too. You got to be
exactly.
able to control that.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's so, not a sense of calm. It's just controlling the anxiety.
Exactly. Okay. We're at 48 minutes. Do you want to go on to the next one, or should we take a quick break?
I got to pee.
All right.
If that answers your question.
All right, folks.
Apparently.
Once again, Darren's bowels are controlling the podcast.
You can pee during the
kidney,
next point.
Kidney.
All right, folks. We're going to take our traditional quick break. We'll be back after everyone's poured a drink and had a pee. We'll be back in a bit.
There, that's what I got to do is pour a drink.
Giddy up. Okay, folks, we're back from the break. We're going to go on to the second talking point. I'm going to approach the second talking point as it's written, but I listened more to the podcast I took this from, and there was a little bit more to it than is defined here. So we'll talk about this as it is, but then I want to bring in the rest of it that I heard when I was listening to the podcast I took this from today. So let's just deal with the talking point as it stands. So the way it reads now is, the value of rank is determined, at least in part, by the goals of the individual practitioner. Meaning, if you join a karate club because you want to be an effective street fighter or an effective fighter in a tournament, then your rank should be based on your ability to do that. If you join a karate club because you want to lose weight and you want to get in better shape, then if you accomplish those things, then you should be promoted based on your particular goals inside of the club that you joined. So there you go. Should we be basing rank on the goals of the individual as opposed to some objective standard? Rick, you're chuckling. You go first.
We have a, what Darren keeps calling and other people's, a syllabus. The syllabus says you need this for this rank, this for this. And that's been set up, and it, as far as I'm concerned, works really well. That is our progress for your road to get rank. If you're a really good fighter and you can't do kata, you will not get ranked. I totally agree with the way we do it.
So individual goals should have nothing to do with the progression of the training or the rank through the training.
So
is that
some
right?
guy comes in and says, my individual goal is I want to be able to stand on my 2 feet and put my hands in front of me. Okay, I'm a black belt now.
As sarcastic as you were, that's
exactly.
not
exactly
that's not an unreasonable interpretation of this.
Well,
but
that's what I'm reading out of it.
I think this is a touchy one, because we've had the conversations before about whether people advance to the next rank based on their performance and level of skill, and that's always been kind of the contentious argument or fact or whatever. Is that if they are doing the best that they can and they're there all the time, are we giving them credit for that, or are we just stopping them in their tracks because they're not doing the syllabus as to a degree that is required to wear the next rank? That's where sometimes I lean toward not having a rank system, and you just get better as you go, and that's good. Nobody ranks you. But the whole ranking system, I think, is set up as a incentive or a motivator, or at least a guideline to get you to perhaps when you first start, everybody knows your goals and your values change as you progress in the art. So you might have started it just to learn self-defense or just to get fitness. But as you got into it and got really passionate about it, you may change your goals and everything. So then you're, by that nature, you know, your values are going to change as well. So how do you approach the ranks? So I don't know. I like both ways. Do you know what I mean? I like what Rick said, that it's black and white. That's what you got to do, and that's it. But then it seems to alienate a lot of people that are in it for different reasons. So it's. I think there should be a syllabus so that there is a guideline, there is a structured class to get you to a certain level. And if you stray during that or start to become more interested or more passionate about different aspects of the martial arts, that's fine, but the guideline is still there. And I think the same is in music or learning another language, that here's how the course is. Now, you can get to the end of the course and still not be able to speak the language, but you have progressed through the course. You've learned everything they've had it to teach you. You might have forgot a lot of stuff on the way, therefore you can't speak the language, but you have finished the course. So I like that aspect where there is a system that you have to follow through. But to actually maybe get a certificate or something, that doesn't mean you're better than anybody else. It just means you've taken whatever it is, the instruction and practice, up to that level. Whether you're good at it or not is irrelevant. You get your certificate or belt or whatever the ranking system is. And I think we talked about that before in a podcast like a year ago about people going and taking a psychology course or an engineering course or even a medical course. That doesn't make them good at what they do. It just means they've taken the course. And they can walk away with the master's degree or a doctorate, but that doesn't mean they're good at it. And they're certainly not better at it than the people that excel in it. But they've done the course, they've earned the title, but just because they're not as good as somebody else. Like, at what point do you, like, what is the comparison to? The best in the world? None of us are that. Do you know what I mean? So you kind of have to lower the standards at some point and say, what are you as an individual trying to achieve? I guess basically what I'm saying is I kind of agree with that, the statement.
Although Rick put it in a really cartoony way, I'm right on track with what he said. And I love the metaphor of a piano school, a piano teacher running a school. What kind of ranks would they have, and how much would the individual practitioner's goals have to do with whether they achieve those certificates? Nothing, really. You can either play Rachmaninoff's Second Concerto properly, or you can't. Yes, okay, it's subjective. They have a little heavy-handed on whatever. But there is to the practical most degree a standard, an objective standard to which the student must get there. Sorry for the bad grammar. And that's the proper way. The goals of the individual practitioner of a piano school don't matter. And that's what matters in the integrity of the school.
This is a very complicated question. And in my mind, it boils down to help make sense of this question. My Neanderthalic brain has boiled it down to the perspective of either rank is awarded objectively or subjectively. And I think that's kind of the crux of all of these arguments. Are there subjective standards by which people should be judged, or should people be judged by as objective a standard as is possible? Now, let's look at those extremes. Speaking subjectively, which means, look, you're just judging by whatever standard floats across the cosmos at the moment you're judging somebody. That's the perspective that ends up with people, and pardon the callback to an earlier podcast, someone with no arms and no legs getting a black belt. Because the standard for judging their ability is completely subjective. This person cannot do a block or a kick. Relative to that individual's progress, is that enough? Apparently. You know what I mean? So is it a subjective standard by which we judge, or is it an objective standard? And to add one more layer to this conversation, there are martial arts out there that judge progression through rank comparatively. You have to be better than somebody else, or you have to beat somebody else of a higher rank in order to progress to that rank.
That's judo and jiu-jitsu.
Right, exactly. So this is a complex question. It's so complex, and we've all faced this at gradings. Oh, this person's not really that good. Yeah, but they try really hard, gosh darn it. So let's subjectively give them their rank. I'm going to take a stand and say any rank that is awarded outside of a comparison to an objective standard is irrelevant. I think that's where I fall on this.
This all echoes the wokeism that's of recent times.
Yeah.
It's not recent. We've been dealing with this for years. For decades. So it's not
well,
recent.
I'm old, so it's recent to me. But anyway, go ahead.
Rick, what do you think? How do we judge somebody ready for rank? Is it subjective? Is it objective? Is it comparative? What's the answer?
Personally, I look at a couple of different things. One, there has to be at least their familiarity with the syllabus, and they have to know certain things to get certain ranks. Beyond that, there has to be the effort. Beyond that, there has to be, you know, that they show up on class, they come to club stuff, they participate. Now, the comparison part is, okay, do they do a front kick the way you do it, Mitch? Do they do it the way I do it? Or do they do it the way John does it? Because take the three of us, right? We all do our front kicks a little differently. We all have a different, little bit different power in the kicks.
There's a right way to do a front kick and a wrong way. And people can do them better or more powerfully than others, but there's a right way and there's a wrong way. And it's not fair to put our ability to do kicks in there because we're old.
Okay, yeah, but Bob, hang on a second. Wait a second, Bob. Yes, there's an objective motion that your leg has to follow to do a correct front kick.
Yes.
But let's assume, and I would hope by green belt, that a student has pretty much got the hang of that. After that, how do you judge their front kick? Just because it comes up and goes out in the right direction? That's enough to say they've got a good front kick? Because once you've got the basic movement down, the judgment after that becomes completely subjective because the objective part's already been taken care of.
To put something, a phrase like considerable strength and power as a clause in the requirement for a front kick, I don't think is unfair.
What is okay, but you're just conceding that it becomes subjective. The word considerable is by definition subjective.
Sure. Yes, and that's what defines a good teacher from a bad one, one that can distinguish those well.
But even that's subjective. Deciding whether someone's a good teacher or not depends on your perspective of what their ability is.
We're not talking about judging teachers. We're talking about the teachers themselves. They're either a good teacher or they're not. We're not talking about our judgment of them.
Just to follow this through, they're either a good teacher or a bad teacher. Based on the context of what we've been talking about, how do you define the difference?
No. A good teacher is one with good judgment. I mean, that's as far as you can go.
You realize the futility of that statement, right?
Not at all. It's what all of our legal system is based on.
Then what's good judgment? In terms of a martial arts instructor, you just said that a good instructor shows good judgment. That's
right.
That's incredibly vague and unspecific. So,
The hard part of any process in this goddamn society we live in is pinning down what we mean by vague terms like that. That's the hard part. We live in a complicated society that's dirty and it's difficult to define, difficult to pull and pin down.
Okay, but you're the one.
Excuse me for trying to do so.
But you're the one who just said there are good instructors and bad instructors. You said that, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think it's unreasonable for me to ask you, by what standard do you judge good and bad instructors? Apply a little bit of objectivity to that incredibly vague definition.
Yeah, fair enough. This is a wildly complicated topic, and it's kind of interesting that we are attacking it in this little podcast episode. But wait, can you not distinguish between a strong sidekick and a weak one?
Wait.
Strictly speaking, just that.
Wait, it's unfair for you to limit me when you're asking that question.
Because you limited me, man. You limited me between good teachers and bad teachers.
All right, let me explain. I'm limiting you. Let me explain. Human beings, as a component of humanity, judge good and bad by their own ability. If I see somebody...
Whoa! Wrong.
Jesus.
Well, when you look at something in a movie, when you see a martial arts technique performed, you go, that's good or that's bad, based on your current or historical ability to do that same technique.
Nope.
Yes.
Not at all.
Yeah,
not a bit.
Absolutely. Yes?
Darren, come in here, Darren.
I was kind of debating when to come in because I was thinking something else that I was waiting for a spot to come in, but it's not what you guys are talking about now. So I'll just hold off and
do I have to be a black belt to judge a strong sidekick as opposed to a weak one?
We're drifting a bit. Let's pull this back in. Let's take this back to how we determine whether someone is ready to or deserving of their rank. The three notions we're talking about are objectivity, subjectivity, or comparative perspectives.
See, it's where it's going to go, because if you're a world champion and have been for years and you've seen it all and done all, your standards are going to be really high. So, or even if you're just going through the ranks at a club and you're 10 times better than everybody at the club, but the standards, whatever they are, whatever they may be, like obviously different clubs have different standards. So we've laughed, we've gone to a tournament and you see somebody with a rank and you're going, how did you get that? Well, that's the standards at that club. Whether it's right or wrong, it's arbitrary. But if you're at your own club, you get some prodigy that comes along and far exceeds anything you can do, despite how much work you put into it. Are we now going to let them be the comparative thing as the standards that you must achieve in order to move to the next rank? Like somewhere the standard's been set, whether it's high or low, whether it changes, but somewhere there is a standard and that's where the ranks are set. Like, where do you draw the line is kind of that arbitrary thing.
Darren, what Darren just said actually supports the argument I just made, which is, when you go to a tournament, or someone, like Darren had just said, someone who's a world champion is going to have a really high standard of what's good and what's bad. That's because that person will look at what other people can do compared to their own ability and the ability in which they are used to functioning. And they will judge based on that. So they will have a much higher expectation than some white belt who's never taken a class before. Anytime someone sees somebody do something that they can't do, they go, wow, that's really good. And when someone sees somebody do something at a lower level than they themselves are able to do, they go, that's not that good. I firmly believe that as much as we try to be objective about technical ability, we largely default to what we as individuals are able to or were able to do at that rank. I think that comparative notion is hardwired into the species.
Fair enough. To say that I can judge somebody according to what I was able to do in my youth is a lot different from saying I'm going to judge that person based on what I can do now. That's a different story.
Okay, so fair enough. Let me rephrase. let me rephrase. People will judge based on their own experience of excellence. How about that?
No, no. All right. Let me add something else. I can tell when somebody does a technique better than I ever could. You're saying that I judge them according to what I was able to do.
And you would like, look, if you see somebody doing something better than you ever could, you would go, wow, that's pretty good.
Yeah, that's good. Exactly.
And if you saw somebody doing something worse than you've done or than you ever could, you would go, they're not doing that very well.
That's a pretty good scale.
Yes, but that was my whole point, that you just threw a clot 2 minutes over or 2 minutes ago when I made that point. You're like, no, that's not right. It's absolutely right.
No,
the point is,
how do we grade people? Do we do
yes, let's
way?
Get
do
back
we
to that. Exactly.
Or do we do objectively?
So how do we grade somebody who's testing for whatever rank? Objectively, subjectively, or comparatively? What's
the problem here? They can do a sidekick better than I ever could. Therefore, they deserve a rank at that point greater than I was at that point in my number of years training.
Right.
Secondly, they can't do a technique that I could at that rank. Therefore, they shouldn't pass. Like, what's the problem?
So you're saying that everybody should be judged based on your perception of how good you are or were at that point.
Right. Whether I'm a good enough judge of ability, that's my problem.
And you get that that leads to the shitty state of martial arts in Ontario right now.
Oh, I have no doubt.
Okay, as he wanders away to get a drink. How can you defend that perspective when you've seen the end result of it?
Because that's all we have.
No, it's not. We can judge objectively.
Can we?
Yeah.
You just said it's not objective.
Wait, what did I say is not objective?
Your whole argument is that it's subjective.
My whole argument is it is human nature to be comparative relative to your own ability. That doesn't mean we have to
surrender. You said it's totally subjective.
That doesn't mean that we have to surrender to that and only think that way.
That's my point! God damn it!
Point is that when we are testing somebody for a particular rank, we can choose to be objective and judge them against an objective comparator. We can be subjective and say, we're going to include things in this decision to promote you that don't have as much to do with that objective comparator. Or we can be comparative and say, you're not as good as that guy who's that rank, therefore you don't get your rank, or you do. I'm asking you to take a stand and say, which one is the best way to judge rank progression?
It's probably a combination of a couple of them.
To speak to what Rick just said, I don't think it should be a combination. Well, I firmly believe it should be objective, period. That's my perspective.
Can you explain what subjective is? It's just a quick question. Which one is subjective?
Subjective is saying, well, you know, we'll include a bunch of stuff that there's no way to measure, and there you go. And you know, they try really hard, and I don't think their technique's that good, so blah, 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 blah. Let's give them the rank, because you know what? They're in there trying, and they come up every week, and I think that's subjective.
You said that's a good way to go.
I said what?
That was a good way to go.
No, that's a horrible way to go.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Yeah, I got confused there.
Yeah. Those people who say that are trying their best to make the point, make the case that they're being objective even though they're not.
Okay. Well, then that might neither here nor there. Which is the best way to judge people's prep or judge people's readiness to move from rank to rank?
I don't think anyone will argue with the idea that it's objective. The problem is people are wrong most of the time about that.
Okay, fair enough, but let's keep it to the topic at hand. So Bob, you're saying objective comparison or objective standards is the way to go, right?
Yeah, yes.
Okay, Darren, what do you think?
I still go by what I said earlier. Like if you're running a studio, I'm not sure how important this is. Like if you're trying to instill whatever your teachings are, whatever your philosophy is on the students, I don't think you need to measure them based on other people to still instill that. So I don't think it's detrimental to have a blue belt that's really good and a blue belt that's not very good. I don't think it's wrecking the standards for the people that are coming up through the ranks, because your job as a teacher is to instill whatever the philosophy is. Other than joking around, I don't sit around and go, how come that guy's got a blue belt and he sucks and this guy's got a blue belt and he's good? I don't give a shit. I'm on my own path and that's what I'm doing. So it's a hard topic, because I remember going up through the ranks, and there was a big thing to get to the rank, and you had to really work hard to get to the rank or you didn't fucking get it. But so that was instilled into and you went. I don't know if that's the best way to do things now, because people don't do the same shit now. Does that mean they shouldn't practice martial arts? If it's going to throw someone into some shitty club because that shitty club hands out belts and they're missing out in the training they could get in the good club just because. Or can you just say, look, you're never going to be a blue belt because you're whatever it is, you're obese or you just don't have the speed, whatever it is, but you can continue to train. You're just never going to progress. I don't know if people can handle that. So you have to kind of find some sort of subjective way to move on.
The real question is whether or not they can handle it. Is that a problem? Is that a deal breaker?
I don't know. I don't know. That might be weird, where someone's just always there as a green belt or whatever the rank is.
The thing is, it's not reasonable to expect somebody to function inside of a karate club or a martial arts club where rank is a part of the environment, and say to them, hey, look, you can still train, but you're never going to get past green belt.
Exactly.
That's not a reasonable expectation.
Why not?
Because the entire club is founded on the notion and is
that you
formatted,
will progress.
Exactly. It's formatted on the notion of progression through rank.
Fair enough. Okay, so don't tell them that, but know it in your heart.
Even with Bob's notion, and mine too, that objective standards are the way to go, even with that perspective comes a certain amount of subjectivity. Because
totally.
The only thing...
Because where are you going to draw the line?
Right. The only thing that you can objectively judge is whether their arms or legs are moving in the correct path. After that, how much power they've got, how much speed they've got, how much focus, all that stuff is completely subjective, because there's no measurement for it other than your own subjective perspective.
Just like in the music school.
If I'm going up through the ranks, there's always someone better, and that's kind of what you're following too. So if you go up and you learn how to teach whatever it is in your teaching, what are you basing your students' progression on? The person that was better than you, or your ability? So now you're the instructor. You're the person doing the grading. What are you basing it on? Because you were looking up to someone else. So do you base your students on that person you looked up to, or on your own ability? And if you're basing it, if you're doing your comparison on the person that you looked up to, you're not doing them a service, because you're not at that fucking level.
Okay, so let's take this conversation one step further. Let's move off how you would determine whether someone's ready to progress through rank, and let's look at, and let's get a little personal here, how do you define your own ability? Do you define your own ability, and did you coming up through the ranks based on a comparative perspective, an objective perspective? We all went through the ranks. We all got various colored belts, and I'm sure we all gave some thought to, do we really deserve these ranks? How did we define our perspective on our own rank, and how should we now that we're more advanced and higher rank?
This whole conversation about whether you deserve it or whatever, and technique and stuff. It reminded me three or four different times of Bob when he was a green belt. And round kicks for green to blue, you should have been able to do a really good round kick and do it with a lot of power and a lot of speed. Where when he was a green belt, Bob's round kicks were a little slow, but he did it properly. Perfect round kick, boom, boom, boom. And then about a year and a half later, when he went for brown belt, he'd kick me in the head before I could blink. Now, should he have gotten his blue belt if he couldn't do that kick, or should he? Because at his green belt, going to green to blue, he probably couldn't do it that fast. As a brown belt, after he got his brown belt, he could. So how do you define what is acceptable and what is not?
That's an easy one. If you wanted to base it on that, you could have withheld the rank. He would continue practicing, and his kick would get really good, and he'd get the next rank the next time around. So that's pretty
straightforward. At the next time around.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he didn't. Okay. He went ahead anyway, but he still worked on it, and he got faster.
Okay. Let's get off how we're judging other people and get on to how we're judging ourselves. How do you judge your own ability? Do you judge it based on, or coming up through the ranks? I'm actually more interested in how we defined our place in the structure. Were we just completely subservient to whatever rank we had and said, because Sensei Bell said this, this is how I feel? Did we look at other people and judge ourselves compared to them? Like, what was your yardstick in measuring your own worth coming up through the ranks?
Higher belts. Always looked at the higher belts and went, I got to be able to do that. No matter what rank it was.
Interesting. Bob.
I, in my youth, always trusted perhaps too much in the authenticity and the authority, and assuming that authority was earned of my teachers, whether it was in school or university or in the martial arts club. And I completely gave myself over to the standards and the gradings and the thing that you do, what do you call it? I don't care. The stuff you're supposed to do and the authority of my teachers. I always gave myself over to that. I don't know if Rick remembers, but we graded at the same time for Shodan. And I was in a private conversation with Mark Bell, and I literally said, if I don't deserve this rank, I don't want it, trusting that if he gave it to me, I deserved it. And that was the state of mind I was in all through my youth and my going through the ranks.
Darren, how did you measure yourself coming up through the ranks?
Just to be honest with you, I don't recall a lot as far as measurement. I think you just went in and you just did your stuff. Like, I don't recall measuring and worried about whether it was good enough or bad enough, because I think there was so many people in the club at the time. There was just a sea of people, and you just did what you did. And you just tried your best. And I think you measured with anybody usually that you would be sparring with or doing lines with. Kata, that's subjective, I think, whether something looks good or not. But I think it was just how you held your own. And if you could hold your own, then you accepted it. And a lot of it was what Bob just said. You relied on the hierarchy to decide. So you just kind of went through the ranks. If you took the test, you took the test. If you passed the test, you moved on. And I don't remember giving it much thought beyond that. I'm sure I did. I don't recall giving it much more. I think it was, if you're in a class with just that rank or something, okay, you're comparing it with everybody else at the rank. But you were generally in classes from lower belts, so you can always obviously see that you're better than them. And there was always higher belts, and you can see that you have something to strive for. So you just kind of went through the motions. I'm not sure I paid much attention to the actual rank itself.
You know, it's funny, for myself coming up through the ranks, I was in the same boat that Bob was, which was I completely surrendered to the structure of the club and the word of the head instructor. And I remember for myself, and I trained for a few years under that umbrella, under that perspective. And I remember vividly the moment I stopped thinking that way, which was, I was promoted to a blue belt without a grading. There was a class, and Mark Bell just said, Mitch is getting promoted to his blue belt. We're not going to have a grading, and I got my blue belt. And that was the moment, that flipped my introspection into high gear. And after that, I was like, because I was always so self-deprecating and so not confident in my ability, that him promoting me, because I was so not confident coming up through the ranks, his promoting me, this is a weird thing, and I'm having a little bit of a epiphany here, and it's starting to hurt my head. Him promoting me to that blue belt, I think, was the first moment I started to doubt my faith in the structure of that club. Because I was promoted without having to go through the trappings of what you had to go through to go from rank to rank. So when that happened to me, I was like, wow, I don't know that I trust this structure anymore. And from then on, my yardstick for my own ability stopped being what other people thought and started being, there is an objective, universal truth about how these techniques should be done, and that's what I have to measure myself against. Yeah, go ahead, Bob.
Sorry, dude. Go finish it.
No, I'm done. I'm done.
There's this thing called an imposter syndrome that people suffer when they really don't feel they deserve the position that they're in, and that echoes with my mindset and maybe yours.
For sure, it absolutely does. To this day, that may be in part why I do not have any of my black belt certificates hanging on a wall. They're all sitting on top of a cupboard gathering dust. Now, there's more to it than just that, and I think intellectually there's a lot more to it than just that, but certainly back in my blue belt, brown belt days, there was a real crisis of faith in terms of how do I judge my worthiness of the rank I'm holding or the rank I'm progressing toward. And it stopped being subjective based on the people who were ranked above me at the club. And it started being more comparative to an intellectual understanding of what perfection is. And I struggle with that to this day. When I do a kick, I don't judge it against what anyone else thinks. I judge it against my intellectual understanding of what a perfect kick should look like. That's a thing. Anyway, all right, let's go one more time around the table. Talk about rank and progression through rank as objective, subjective, or comparative. Anything else you want to say? Let's start with Darren.
Oh, I think I said it all in the last statement. I think I could go either way. It depends on your own goals. Are we doing this as a student or an instructor? Or so as a student, if you have your goals and the club isn't meeting it or it's holding you back or whatever, you just go somewhere else. It's simple as that. If you're an instructor, you got to determine whether is it a money making thing? Do you want the best students possible? And then you're going to curtail your subjectivity or objectivity or whatever the term is to fit those values. So I think the whole thing is arbitrary. You have to decide what your goals are and run with that. And if you're happy with your ranks or non-ranks or whatever it is, that's up to you to decide. And as an instructor, you got to do the same thing. You stick to, I think the whole thing is you pick your value, you pick the way you want to do it, and then you stick to that. So if you want to do it comparatively or objectively or whatever it is, it is, and it's made perfectly accountable and transparent from the start that's how the club runs, as I said, as a student or an instructor. So I don't think any of them are bad ways to do it. I just think you gravitate to what you feel is the best for you as an individual or an instructor, and that's the end of it. I don't think anyone can say one is bad, one's the other. I think it's just you go to whichever one you feel is best.
Rick?
Well, I've said it pretty short, in a very short way. There's a couple of ways of grading people. I think they both have merits. I think they both have problems. But it's, you got to have a syllabus. You got to have at least a basic form of what needs to be done and what doesn't need to be done. And if you get to the point where you're not thinking that you're getting the right training, I mean, like Darren said, you just go to another club. But if you get into the club, you've got to look around, and lower belts don't really have enough training yet to realize what they're looking at or what they should be looking at. So it's like you get in the same club or you go to another club, then like you guys have all gone to other clubs. Do you not recognize the ranks from those clubs? I mean, it's probably similar there too. I mean, you've got to look at the teachers, you got to look at the students, you got to look at where you rank in those. So it's like, do you not agree that you should have been presented your black belt when you got your black belt? I mean, okay, that's, well then give it back if you don't think that then.
Bob.
I envy jiu-jitsu and judo clubs because their ranking system depends, as you mentioned before, on who they beat. And is that not objective? Yes, that's as close to objective as we can get in the martial arts. But the thing is, we in our styles not only judge people according to how well they compete against others, which we do what? Like maybe 5%? 5% of somebody, of how we judge a student is how well they compete against others. And the other 95, to your point, Mitch, is subjective. It's our judgment of their state of mind. It's their judgment of their personality. It's our judgment of maybe their ability to do kata. It seems way too slippery, a grading concept, a way to grade somebody. I really wish we could tie competition more closely to rank.
I don't know, man. I'm really torn on this one. I see the value in a structure that requires competition and defeating people of a higher rank as criteria for you moving through the rank. My heart goes out to anybody who's a lower belt in any system, because unless you've got a strictly defined syllabus, a strictly defined set of requirements for progression through the ranks, like at our club right now, it's incredibly subjective. There's so much subjectivity that I think it almost makes what is objective pointless. And I've seen a lot of clubs like that, oh, well, you know, this person comes a lot, they try really hard, blah, blah, blah. I'm going to input all of this subjective perspective onto whether this person should get their ranks or not. It makes it insanely hard for students to get a realistic or, what's a better word than realistic, an objective perspective on their own ability. I've seen students in the club who come up to me and say, I don't think I deserve the rank I have. And I'm like, what are you basing that on? And they don't have a solid foundation for their response because the requirements are so all over the map. It's an incredibly complex question. And I'm starting to think, man, I keep flip-flopping on this. I'm starting to think, again, that we should just go to a white and black. You're white belt till you get a black belt. And none of this matters.
There is something to that.
Like, none of this matters if all you are is a white belt. And maybe get rid of ranks completely. There are martial arts. There are fighting arts, boxing specifically, where rank doesn't exist. You just work out and you do the stuff you do. And it becomes obvious who's good and who's not and who's getting better and who isn't. And maybe that's the way to go. I'm starting to think that sort of structure works more to everybody's benefit than this whole complex rank to rank thing.
And there is something when like, because then there's no, oh, he got to black belt before me. It's like, yeah, he's better than you. There's nothing more to it than that.
Exactly.
So there's each rank, it's like, do I deserve this rank? Is that guy better than me? How long does it take to get to the next rank? How long is the string? You just sit there and you just work out, and maybe one day you'll get your black belt. and who knows when that one day is, then there's no pressure. You just work out as hard as you want in the interim. And if you get there, then you've obviously put in the effort and you've reached the level of skill that that club dictates or necessitates or whatever. And if you don't, then you don't know. There's no determined, yeah, it takes 2 years or it takes 3 years. You just go.
Yeah, I was just going to say, again, I feel envy for the Brazilian jiu-jitsu clubs, because just as Darren said, you go in and you fight and you rise naturally according to who's better. I laugh in my head. What's wrong with that? Whoever's better gets higher in rank. I don't know. It's hard to get past that.
And to speak to both of your points, that's exactly the kind of structure that boxing clubs have. And like Darren was saying, look, you just go in and you work out. And it becomes obvious who's better and who's not. And it becomes obvious who's getting good at the techniques and who isn't. And I'm starting to think that that's the only way that makes sense.
But remember the structures of our clubs with kata and with lines, and there is not really any competition in there. How do you determine this?
Because there is a head.
If you
person.
Can't block people's punches in lines, if you can't block their kicks in lines, if you can't spar properly in, at the club, you don't have to be in a tournament to realize that someone beside you is better than you.
Exactly. When you watch two people do kata, they know in their head when they're watching themselves relative to the people around them, they know where they sit in their own ability. And that's so do the people who are watching them do it. You know
people
what I mean?
People watching will, but some people don't have that ability, Mitch.
Maybe not. But then they surrender themselves to the person who's running the club. And I've said this before. Like, I've had students come up to me before and say, I don't want to grade. I've been told that I'm eligible to test and that I was told by the head instructor. And that's not necessarily the club I'm in now. It's other clubs I've been associated with. And they say, I don't know if I trust that I earned the rank I'm wearing. And my response to that is always, and I'd like to get everybody's perspective on this. If you don't trust the head instructor of your club to adequately determine or define what your rank should be, you're at the wrong club. If you're not willing to give yourself over to the person who's in charge of that club to define your ability level or your rank level, then you are at the wrong club. You need to go to find somebody that you do have that faith in.
But a 16-year-old kid doesn't have that maturity to make that judgment.
If they've got the maturity to say, I don't know if I earned this rank, then they've got the maturity to make that determination.
No, I can think that I'm inferior without thinking I shouldn't be at this club.
Then what do you say to that 16-year-old who says, I don't know if I earned this rank? What do you say to that person?
I'm the head instructor?
I don't know.
Are you
saying I'm
the head instructor?
No. You're an instructor at that club, and they've come and confided to you that they're not sure that they earned the rank they're wearing. What do you say to them?
Oh, in that case, you're absolutely right. Have a deep think about where you are and what you want.
Right, exactly. If you're not willing to accept the judgment of the individual or individuals who make those determinations, either if you do trust that, then there's your answer. You deserve it. If you don't trust that, maybe you need to look for another club. Rick, what do you think?
Same sort of thing would go for someone who's got a certain rank and figures they should already be at the next rank, too, wouldn't it? Why aren't I a brown belt? I'm a blue belt. I've been a blue belt for a year and a half. I should be a brown belt.
Yeah, and people do that. They'd leave the club. They'd leave the club if they thought they deserved a higher rank and they weren't getting it. They'll fuck off somewhere else.
And that's fine. That's fine.
I know.
Still absolutely. Yeah, exactly. Look, you either trust the instructor of the club to competently determine your skill level or you don't. And if you don't, go to another club. Find someone that you trust more. And if you do, shut up and just accept the rank you're given, because that's the structure and that's what the structure determines your skill level is.
And the instructor competently judging your skill level is all we can expect of objectivity in what we're doing.
Exactly. Well, I think we've solved the world problem.
We've solved all the problems in the world.
We got through 2 points.
Yeah, I know. All right, guys, we're gonna.
Yeah, I want to do the other ones next time. Those are great.
That happens.
Like, we got 2 points out of five. We didn't even make it through halfway.
I know.
Well, if you guys had stopped thinking so much and just shut the hell up, we maybe wouldn't have these problems.
Don't even come up with new topics. Just use the next three that were there, and just it's
okay. Fair
podcast
enough.
Podcast cannibalism part.
Cannibalism
two.
Part two. All right, folks, we're going to bring this one to a close. Let's go around the table once. Any comments you guys want to make about anything we've talked about tonight? Before we do that, I want to say shout out to Lenny. I'm sorry Lenny couldn't be on.
Sorry, bud.
I think you might have had some interesting things to say.
I don't. No, we don't have to listen.
Oh, right, we already established he doesn't know anything about Kata, so that would even make
sense. There you go.
Lenny, I'd just like to say that I'm on your side. Okay, once around the table, any last comments you want to make? Let's start with Bob.
Oh, man, it was great. I wasn't looking forward too much to this episode.
I love it when Bob says stuff like that.
I looked at the talking points like a half an hour
drag
before.
Myself
I
was like, into it.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay. I probably have a couple of thoughts, but Jesus Christ, we got into it, and I enjoyed it. I'm sorry I got vocal. But that's part of the thing, and it's part of the fun. I hope you guys took it in the spirit in which it was meant,
in the violent spirit in which it was intended. Okay, Rick, any last comments?
Not too much. The second one we started getting into with the rank and that, it's actually if you read what you put down as the points, if you want strictly self defense, you should go to a club that only fights. If you want weight loss and physical fitness, you should go to a gym. That's not really why you join a karate club or a judo club or an aikido club like Bob did, right? Especially aikido, you get those benefits, but you want to learn the aikido.
You're getting into the next talking points. What the fuck?
That's stop.
No,
let the man have his last comment, and then we're moving on.
Yeah. That's it. Just
Darren.
No, let him finish. Go ahead.
I'm done.
Oh, he's done.
Just on that, like we established that your values and goals change. So I think if you just want to go to learn weight loss and you end up in a gym and they're just doing stupid shit, you're like, I'm not losing any weight. This is stupid. But you might go to a karate class and just immerse yourself in it, and you lose weight as a result of immersing yourself in karate. So I don't like the idea of just saying, here, if you want to do this, go here. If you want to do this, go. No, let everybody go in and then let them make a decision afterward whether they want to change. So that was just a rebuttal to that. It's not my last statement. I think, again, when I read the topics, I'm like, Jesus, where are we going to go with this? Like, I was thinking about it earlier because if you go to a party or a campfire or whatever it is, you don't go there with a topic. It just naturally happens. But when you get the topic thrown at you, it's almost like throwing a curveball and going, well, what the fuck are we going to say about this? What's it going to talk? But you don't know what anybody else is going to say, and it gets a bit confusing. And then when you get in there, you just get wrapped up. Like I said, I don't want to leave now. I could talk about this shit all night. But as far as the actual topics, the one thing that I was thinking is, okay, it was taken from, we'll say, a professional or expert or at least someone that's knowledgeable just based on the time spent. So I think if we came up, or we've come up with loads of statements in these podcasts that somebody else might listen to and do this same kind of podcast and have rebuttals or debunked all the things we said. So at the same time, it's not that we're on high horses, because I think everybody here agrees that we're all open to suggestions, we're all open to learn, and we'll take other people's opinions. But I wonder, could someone take apart what we're saying and do the same kind of podcast and go, yeah, these guys are full of shit, man. Like, Kata does promote calm mindset and sparring. Do you know what I mean? Like, who's to say somebody else isn't doing the same thing and dissecting what we say and actually come up with their reasoning as to why we're wrong and they're right?
That's awesome. It's an interesting thing. Do that.
I mean, realistically, we're right. But, I mean, I'm entertaining the thought that somebody else could also think that they're right.
The we thing are right is, for us.
We look, I invite that. If someone wants to listen to this and they've got some rebuttals or anything they want to say, look, if they want to go on their own podcast and do it, more power to you. If you want to come on this one and we can have that discussion, I'm absolutely open to that as well. Anyway, look, I think I've spouted off enough for one podcast. Thank you guys for coming on. I know it was a weird time. We recorded this on a Monday night, and I've got to put it up Tuesday morning, so I've got some work ahead of me in terms of editing. But thanks you. That's great. Thank you to Bob, Rick, and Darren. I'm sorry that Lenny couldn't come on. Sincerely, I think he might have had some interesting stuff to add. Once again, any comments, questions, please to my personal Facebook page, the No Mind Podcast Facebook page, or throw an email at nomindpodcast2021@gmail.com. It's been a great conversation. I've loved it. Thank you so much, guys. And we're done. We're out. We're done. Woo-hoo. Thanks. Yowza.
Wonderful. The bullets of logic and just decency bounce
decency.
Off of some drone's mouth.
We're getting personal now.
The bullets of decency.